Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Officer steps outside, alerts the other officers, and oversees Sean Bell and his undercover, and his bachelor party fighting with a guy in an SUV. All of this escalates to the point where the undercover officer by the name of Jessgard is Nora steps in front of Sean Bell's car where he's sitting in the driver's seat with his friend Joseph Guzman in the passenger seat. Trent Benefield is in the back. Undercover officer is Nora, pulls out his gun, aims it at Sean Bell's car. Sean Bell drives forward, strikes the officer in the leg, backs up, strikes a police van, begins to drive towards the undercover officer again. Undercover officer Nora shoots his gun and starts a chain of events which leads to the 50 bullets. By the end of the night, Sean Bell's dead, his friends are wounded. The officers say that they were justified in opening fire.
So Michael, why did we end up getting 50 shots fired at this car?
Well, one of the theories is this theory of contagious fire, right, where the officers believed they were being fired upon and so just kept shooting. Another theory that we're expected to hear more about at trial is the way that officers are trained, which is just to shoot without, you know, counting your bullets. Shoot until the threat is basically taken care of. So, like, for example, one officer, Detective Oliver, fired 31 of the 50 shots, the majority, and alone. And that when he was questioned by police minutes after the shooting, he didn't know whether he had fired any rounds.
Right. And so you're saying that the training is shoot until the threat is stopped?
Yes.
In addition, that the confusing part is going to be that there's going to be the issue of training, and then there's going to be the issue of what is criminal. The police code is you're not supposed to shoot past a certain point when you think that the threat has been immobilized. However, those are not the criminal boundaries. If you are going to charge someone with the crime of manslaughter in an instance where they opened fire on a moving car, there is going to be an issue of whether they were doing so in self-defense. If this car, as in Mr. Wilson's article today, if this car can be perceived as a deadly weapon in and of itself because it struck this undercover officer once, because it's a 3,000-pound car coming at him again, if there's reasonable belief that this car is coming to harm him, if he is armed, he is allowed to use that weapon to defend himself. Whether he's allowed to do so as an officer or not isn't as much of an issue in the criminal trial because it's not a departmental hearing. It's not to determine whether or not he did correctly as an officer. It's to determine whether or not he did correctly as a civilian of New York.
So, Michael, tell me about the defendants. Who are they, and how many shots did they fire, and what are they charged with?
Well, the two detectives with the most severe charges are Detective Isnora, the undercover who fired the first round and then 10 more after it, and Detective Oliver, who fired the 31 rounds. The third officer, Detective Mark Cooper, fired 4 rounds and is not charged with manslaughter. He is charged with a misdemeanor of reckless endangerment. One of his rounds went astray and broke the window of an air train station.
Right, that's the video we saw. It was like a block away or something.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So what kind of punishment are they facing if they're convicted?
Well, if convicted of manslaughter, I think the sentence could go 25 years to life.
But then the third one faces a significantly lighter sentence.
Yes,
right?
Yes, more like a matter of a year or so,
right,
if I recall.
So they wanted to move this case out of Queens to get a more neutral jury, but that was denied, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And so they waived the right to a trial by jury after that. How unusual is that?
Maybe Ms. Bode should answer this one. She'd know better than I, but it's
there's a precedent, certainly, for going to a bench trial. That's the name for when you waive your jury rights. It's considered a bench trial where you put it in the hands of a judge. There's a precedent for that, certainly, in police shooting trials in particular, because I think that that police are under the impression that when you're speaking directly to a judge, there's the less emotion involved. When you're appealing to a jury, the appearance of a widow who has children, whose fiancé was killed on his eve of his wedding day. Those are all things that would be particularly affected
who
on
makes
the jury.
Who makes that call?
It's always a defendant's right in a state case, not in federal. In a state court, defendants always have the right to waive their jury rights.
But does he make? Do the defendants make that appeal to an appeals court, or
yeah.
is the
no? Actually, it's something that
the
they
presiding
do in Supreme Court. It's not even a request. It's when a set of defendants is about to go to trial. Before the voir dire or jury selection process begins, they have an option to sign a waiver. So it's a default right. They don't have to appeal to anyone to approve it. It's always their choice, and it cannot be argued in a state court if you want to waive your jury rights. That is not the case, however, in federal court. You have to get the prosecutor's approval in order to go directly to a judge, which very rarely happens. But in a state court, there's no boundary or there's no hurdle that you have to overcome. It's just if you choose not to have a jury, that's your right, and if you choose to waive it, that's up to you.
So who's the judge in this case, and what do we know about him, Michael?
Arthur Cooperman is 74 years old. He's been a judge, over 30 years, going on 30 years anyway. And, you know, he's covered in 30 years as a state Supreme Court judge in Queens. You're going to cover the gamut. He has tried police officers. In the famous stun gun case from the 80s, police officers who were convicted of torturing and abusing a suspected teenage drug dealer with their stun guns to provoke a confession from him. He convicted them. Then he convicted a man who killed two police officers on the Garden State Parkway. He shot them while in transit to Rikers Island.
So can we glean anything from some of his decisions over the past 20 years about where he falls, generally pro or anti-police?
No, I don't think so. And you talk to people, and they say, well, people point to the stun gun case and say, look, he's anti-police. But then other people say, no, look, he's done this and this and this.
Nicole, what did you find?
Yeah, certainly I would say across the board, both prosecutors and defense attorneys respect him as a fair middle-of-the-road judge. He doesn't make his decisions based on an agenda. He makes the decisions based on the facts, is the opinion of him in throughout Queens, I would say.
Michael, in your piece today, you talked about the pros and cons of having this be heard before a judge as opposed to a jury. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, each side possibly gives up a little bit before the judge in the emotional context. The prosecution would likely, before a jury, spend more time with Mr. Bell's fiance, more time with Mr. Bell's father, and whatever other family members that they could call to testify, which would, possibly provoke an emotional reaction in the jury if you have a tearful witness and sort of heart-wrenching testimony. Before just a judge, that sort of testimony might not last as long. He might say, okay, we can move along, some such. On the other hand, with the defense, they may have spent more time discussing things like criminal backgrounds of the victim and the wounded men, and in an effort to sort of sway the jury, whereas the judge will say, well, I noted, but let's move on.
Yeah. Nicole, is this going to result, do you think, in a faster trial?
Absolutely. I think that there are certain things that the judge has the luxury of stipulating, which is a nice way of saying, yes, I know, I've read this legal document, I've read this grand jury testimony, I'm gonna take it into record because I'm the only person who needs to know about this. You don't need to read it aloud in court, and you don't need to go through it point by point. We can all just say, has everyone read the grand jury minutes from such and such defendant, so stipulated, and then move on. This could shave off, I don't know precisely how much, but I mean, this trial was estimated to run anywhere from 2 to 2.5 months. It's possible that this could shave off, at least, a half of a month, if not more.
How much are some of these extenuating circumstances going to factor in, like the aspect of the strip club or the fact that Sean Bell's alcohol level was above the legal limit for driving?
I think you'll see the defense make some hay out of the alcohol limit. That you know, suggest that that level of intoxication, you know, can cause erratic and you know, not thinking behavior.
It's a bit of a double-edged sword, though, because as you noted in your story today, and as has been discussed before, both of the undercover officers, Detective Cooper and Detective Isnora, were inside of the club prior to the shooting, and as such, they were allowed to have up to two drinks inside the club in order to keep cover. Now, the lawyers have been very quick to note that the undercovers were evaluated at the scene by a commanding officer and found to be fit for duty, but this is pre-mandatory breathalyzer policy that was instituted by the NYPD following the shooting. So, you know, there's really no way of measuring that. You know, we know how much alcohol was in Sean Bell's system. We don't really know how much alcohol was in the system of the undercovers. So certainly that's going to be something that the prosecutors are going to bring up as well.
Yeah, Michael, you quoted somebody in your piece today saying that the judge has seen a million rap sheets. So what Sean Bell's criminal history may have been, or the criminal history of some of his some of the other passengers in his car, might not hold sway as much?
Correct. Absolutely. I mean, whereas a jury could possibly dwell more on that sort of background information, the judge will just kind of take it for the relevance that it's worth to him.
David Cruz in for Brian Lehr on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking with Nicole Bell, who's a staff writer for the New York Daily News. I'm sorry, Nicole Bodie.
Thanks.
And that's your fault, Michael. Michael Wilson is also Metro reporter at the New York Times. Both of them are covering the Sean Bell trial, which starts on Monday. Now, I understand Sean Bell's father and his fiance are going to testify first, and that allows them to then attend the rest of the trial. What will they be questioned about?
The first one to go on it will be the fiance, Nicole Paltry Bell. She is expected to testify to the fact that it was her car that Sean was driving that night. She had loaned him her Nissan Altima that he and his wounded friends were inside when the 50 shots went off. She could also be asked to testify about the fact that she identified Sean's body at the morgue following the shooting. It's possible that they could go into more detail, but as Michael said, they're not likely to need as much emotion out of her if they're appealing to the judge and not a jury. In Mr. Bell's case, it's probable that he would be questioned about the fact that he was at that nightclub the night of the shooting. He was at his son's bachelor party, but left approximately 20 minutes before the shooting happened. So, he could be asked about that. He recalls in an interview that he did with the Daily News in October, said that he saw an undercover who he later found out was Detective Isnora sitting at a table with a drink in his hand. Now, he could be questioned about that. He could also be questioned about the fact that he claims it was too loud in that club to hear anybody arguing with anybody, which could go to the detective's arguments that they heard that someone had a gun and they heard this woman that they called a prostitute complaining about people who were threatening her. Whether or not they could have heard anything in that kind of detail with loud music blaring is probably going to be a point of contention.
David Cruz in for Brian Lehr on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking with Nicole Bodie, staff writer for the New York Daily News, and Michael Wilson, Metro reporter at the New York Times. Let's take a quick call in here. Eric is in Manhattan. Eric, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You have a question?
Is it standard to take a blood test for a dead person? I mean, it seems kind of strange to me.
Not only the blood test, there were three tests done, and that is routine, is my understanding, and then autopsy. To test your alcohol, they test your blood, urine, and the fluid in your eye, believe it or not. And all three of those come out with a different reading, depending on how much fluids have been added to your body by paramedics and whatnot. That all those things affect your blood alcohol content.
All right. I'm going to have to leave it there. David Cruz in for Brian Lehr. We've been talking with Nicole Bodie, staff writer for the New York Daily News, and Michael Wilson of the New York Times about the Sean Bell trial, which starts on Monday. Thanks, both of you, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, two radio rookies share their stories.